Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the Fourth Amendment. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. So, happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, all of the above, and, of course, the first hour of our Friday program, Senator Bernie Sanders, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, the independent from Vermont. I think of him as America's senator. His website's sanders.senate.gov, and I got your newsletter, Bernie. Bernie, first of all, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And your newsletter, the headline, over Sanders' opposition, Senate overhauls eavesdropping rules.
Yeah.
This took a bite out of a lot of us, I think.
It did. It was a bad vote. We have a president who, as I've said many times, will go down in history as certainly the worst president in modern times and one of the worst in our history. Among his many acts of dereliction, clearly, is his contempt for the Constitution. He is not understanding that, in fact, you can protect the American people from terrorism, which is a serious issue, without undermining the Constitution and the rule of law. I particularly objected to giving immunity to these telephone companies who may very well have violated the law. Citizens have a right to sue. The precedent being established here says, essentially, in the future, that any president of the United States can go to a private sector company and say, look, I am the president. I am telling you what to do. And you don't have to worry about it because I'm the president and I've told you what to do. And it doesn't matter whether it's legal or constitutional. That's a very, very bad precedent. I hope that in the months and years to come, we can not only revisit this issue, but other attacks on our constitutional rights.
Yeah, I hope so, too, because the other end of that spectrum is that now, having given them civil immunity, the only thing left is criminal immunity, and the Constitution gives, you know, barring an impeachment proceeding, gives George W. Bush the right with a stroke of a pen to delete all criminal liability. He could simply pardon all these guys in advance,
We have an administration which really does not understand the Constitution and does not respect the Constitution. And you know, one of the many areas they have been a disaster. But, I mean, believe me, Pfizer is not the only issue that we're dealing with right now. We got the absurdity of the government of Iraq telling the United States there, presumably to protect the people of Iraq, that they want a timetable, and this president saying, we're there to protect you, but we don't want to do what you want us to do. That's right. A bit absurd. And we have a deteriorating foreign policy situation in Afghanistan where the Taliban is regrouping, and we've got to figure out how to deal with that. And then we have a president who is, you know, many people are legitimately concerned about what a war with Iran, which would be just, to my mind, an unmitigated disaster, not just for us, but for, you know, 100 years or longer. It would be a never-ending war. And some of us, I want to mention to people out there that some of us are very cognizant of that and doing our best to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then, obviously, here in Congress, the issue when you go home, and many of us went home for July 4th, the issue that is clearly on most people's minds are the very, very high prices for gas and the fear that when winter comes, oil in my state, in Vermont, home heating fuel will be off the wall, and what we can do about that. And I did want to mention to people that obviously there are a number of approaches that we need to go forward on vigorously, taking on the oil companies, taking on the speculators. But we also need to make sure that coming this winter, people do not go cold. And by the way, this is not just an issue for cold weather states like Vermont. This is an issue for hot weather states like Arizona or Nevada, because right now electric rates are soaring in many parts of this country because of increased fuel prices. And there are a lot of disconnects out there. So, Tom, you should be aware that, you know, thousands and thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, are seeing their electricity disconnected. Well, you know, if you're old and you're sick and you're sitting in Arizona or in Nevada and you can't afford electricity and you don't have air conditioning, you are in deep trouble, because a lot of people die from exposure to heat. So we are working right now on legislation, which I hope I'll have on the floor either next week or the week following, which is a significant doubling of the amount of money that goes to the low-income home energy assistance program, both for cold weather states and warm weather states, to make sure that nobody in America goes cold or dies of heat exposure. So that's an issue we hopefully will make some progress on.
Yeah. And, you know, Bernie, if even if there was no speculation, I mean, Paul Krugman had a column a couple weeks ago where he pointed out that there's no speculation in iron ore futures, and yet the price of iron ore has doubled. That a lot of this has to do with the fall of the dollar, as you well know.
Right.
And if that was the case 10 years ago or 20, actually say 20, 25 years ago, when we had a strong industrial base and the average family had a good union job and people had a little bit of savings and they had equity in their homes, we all had a little elbow room, you
right.
know, and then we could have absorbed this.
That's right, Tom.
And, but, you know, the bottom's been cut out from underneath the
No, that's glass. Exactly right. And as you know, what I did, in my state, and I just asked people, sent out an email, and I asked people, tell me what's going on in your lives economically. We were overwhelmed with the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails that we got. We published it, and it's on our website, by the way. It's called The Collapse of the Middle Class, Letters from Vermont, and America, because we had some letters coming from around the country. And your point is exactly right. It's not just, you know, if the economy was strong, if people were earning decent wages, if people were not struggling with high health care costs, that we were not losing millions of good-paying jobs, sure, no one is happy at $4 a gallon of gas. That's bad. But you could absorb it. But your point is right. What has been going on for a number of years, especially in the last 7 years, is we've seen median household income declining. We've seen poverty increasing. We have seen workers working longer hours for low wages. And this just adds insult to injury, and the injury being the savage attack on the middle class for so many years. And this, as you point out quite correctly, is just taking people over the edge.
Yeah, this is it's the end point, it seems. I think a lot of people are feeling that this is, you know, I without falling back on some hackneyed cliche like the straw that broke the camel's back, but basically that's what this is.
No, that's what it is, because it is. I mean, in my state now, your people who are, we have many, many people who are struggling with their outrageously high health care costs. People can't afford health insurance. We get emails from people who have their whole lives, they wanted to make sure that their kids could go to college. The cost of colleges is now too high. People write to me who tell me they used to have a decent paying job. Their job has now gone abroad and they're working for substantially low wages because of a disastrous trade policy. But you're quite right. I think the energy crisis is the straw that is breaking the back for millions and millions of American workers. And we're seeing, I think, a feeling of anger and frustration out there about what is happening to this great country, where the middle class used to be the backbone of America, and it is being destroyed. Poverty is increasing since Bush has been president. If you can believe this, 8 million people have lost their health insurance. In many parts of America, even if you have health insurance, it's hard to find the primary health care physician, crisis in nurses, dentists, and so forth and so on. So I think, you know, we've had problems for many years, but under this president, in almost every single area, whether it is foreign policy, whether it's the economy, whether it is civil liberties, whether it is global warming, whether it is the loss of our manufacturing base, whether it's the national debt. I mean, you talk about the decline of the dollar, which is directly related to the fact that we have a $9.5 trillion national debt. This president has waged two wars, and you know what? He doesn't want the American people to pay for it. Not today. Yeah. He wants your kids to pay for it, your grandkids to pay for it. Just put it on the credit card. So it is very clear to me, and I think to most Americans, that we need to move this country in a very, very, very different direction in almost every area. And then you hear about our friend Senator McCain's economic advisor, Phil Graham, who is certainly has been, when he was in the Senate, one of the leaders of this right-wing, deregulated, tax breaks for the rich, trickle-down economic theory, which has gotten us exactly where we are right now.
Yeah. Mr. Graham had to say. You just hear this constant whining.
You just hear this constant complaining.
This constant complaining.
Right. The middle class is collapsing, and his friends are making, huge profits. Yeah. And he thinks that people who are hurting are whining. Well, that is why McCain will not be president of the United States.
Well, let us hope. We'll be taking calls. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls next. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, airamerica.com, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio. And Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our first hour has been on every Friday for years and years and years now. And, boy,
Are we that old, Tom? It's been years and years and years and years, huh? Here we are in the old age home just chatting away.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're in the sixth year of this show, and I think you started with us in our first or second year. So it's, as I recall.
Right. Down in WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont.
There you go. And we're still on the air in WDEV
Vermont.
And tip of the hat to Ken Squire, a great guy there who introduced us to each other.
That's right.
So Bernie, ready to take some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay. Your calls for Senator Sanders, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, John in Texas. You're on with Senator Sanders. John?
Yeah, hi. I'm a big fan of both of you guys.
Thank you.
I got cousins that live outside of Brattleboro, and they tell me that President Bush has never visited Vermont, and that's the only state he's never been to since he's been president.
That is right, John. That is exactly right. I gather he's been to 49 states. He has never been to the state of Vermont, and we would like him to visit. We would like him to answer some very hard questions in an open meeting, but I think maybe... that's something that he is not particularly interested in doing.
So you think that's why he hasn't come? Because
I invited him. I saw him last year, and I said, come on, people will be respectful, but they want to ask you hard questions. One of the things that we now assume to be the case, which we shouldn't, is we have a vice president that virtually never appears in public unless it's before the military or a Republican fundraiser. He does not go out in public. And you have a president who does not take questions. People would fall off their chairs if the president went out and said, hey, I'm going to talk to the American people at a town meeting type forum. I do that all the time. Okay, American people, ask me questions. I'll give you my best answer. He doesn't do it.
Yeah.
And I think the people of Vermont would be respectful and appreciative if he did that, but obviously he's not.
Yeah, tragically. Margaret in North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you both. I have a great deal of respect for your integrity. I have been reading and researching for decades. I am in my early 60s. And all of this has been happening for the last 12 years, actually, but really emphasized over the last 7.5 years, is what appears, it comes across as being an intentional destruction of the middle class. And I'm constantly reminded that literally Rome fell when the middle class was wiped out. And I think we're repeating it, and I believe dear God, that a few people in this country are intentionally destroying us to turn us into a third world nation.
Well, Margaret, I think, you know, you raise an interesting point. And I think there's truth to what you were saying. There has been a vicious attack against the middle class in so many ways. From 1945 to 1973, the truth is the American economy grew for the middle class. Low-income people did better, and actually wealthy people did better. But at around that particular point, it appears that the ruling class of this country said, enough is enough. We don't want to share the wealth. We don't want to share more income. We want it all. And at that particular point, what you saw was the beginning of an attack on trade unionism in this country. And unions were very, very important to the growth of the middle class. You saw the growth of the unfettered free trade type effort, which said, we're going to be going abroad to developing countries and force American workers to compete against people who make pennies an hour. There was certainly under Reagan this whole movement of deregulation, of saying that consumers deserve no protection. We're going to remove regulations from the financial service industry. People are on their own. That Milton Friedman mentality that says everybody is out there on their own. So I think Margaret makes a good point, and it's been going on for many, many years. We're seeing certainly an acceleration under the Bush administration. I mean, just one thought comes to my mind. There was just a piece in the paper the other day. You have a president in the midst of this great energy crisis where the oil companies, since he has been president, have made $600 billion in profits since George Bush has been president. Meanwhile, he wants to eliminate the weatherization program by which lower-income people throughout this country can make their homes more energy efficient. I mean, what is that about? It's total insanity.
Burning,
but I give you 1,000 examples of that type of mentality.
In my book, Screwed, I quote a whole number of conservative thinkers, you know, William F. Buckley types from the 60s and the 70s who looked at the student uprisings and the chaos of the 60s and 70s and said, as the conservatives did in the 1870s, by the way, said, this middle class thing is not a good thing. It's leading to social instability. We need to reduce the independence and strength of the middle class so that we will have a more compliant citizenship.
And by the way, as we talk about growing income and wealth inequality in America, that means not only more money, but more power, more campaign contributions from the rich, more lobbying capabilities from the very, very rich. So I think Margaret makes a good point, and that's obviously something that has got to be reversed.
Yeah, absolutely. If democracy is to survive in this country, if for no other reason.
It's not economics, it's democracy.
As well as fairness. 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Program our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Sanders.Senate.gov is Bernie's website if you want to sign up for his newsletter. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, our nation's senator, taking your calls, our national town hall here every Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, listening on WTKG. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Bernie, thank you for making yourself available to the American public. I wanted to talk about this Karl Rove situation. I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. I know the House wants Mr. Rove to testify, and I believe they denied his executive privilege, which he cited.
That's correct. That's my understanding.
I guess I have a twofold question. Number one, how important do you personally think it is that Mr. Rove testify? Number two, how far should the House go to to compel him? Should they threaten him with jail?
Well, you know, I think that Rove certainly has been a mastermind of a lot of the policies of Bush. There's a lot of question. I know that Tom has been raising the issue of Governor Seligman. Is that right?
Siegelman, Don Siegelman. Yeah, he's been on the show a couple times.
Who was arrested, put in jail. There's some question that Rove was involved in, and I think people have a right to answer that. The whole politicalization of the U.S. attorney situation. Certainly Rove was involved in the war in Iraq and misleading the American people. So I think that Rove should testify. And we have laws in this country about people who refuse to obey subpoenas, and I think the House should continue their efforts.
Yeah. Okay. Ken in Hawaii, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I wanted to say just quickly that I get up at 5:30 every Friday morning to listen to Brunch with Bernie.
Oh, Ken, that's very kind of you.
Thank you.
You've got a beautiful state.
I just have a question, and I want to know, all congressmen and representatives, senators and representatives take an oath to support the Constitution, and how are any responsible Americans supposed to vote for anyone, regardless of what office they're running for, who voted to pass the FISA bill?
Well, you know, Ken, every American is going to have to, you know, make a decision as to who they want to vote for president. I voted against the FISA bill. I thought it was a very bad bill, and I have been very concerned from day one about Bush's attacks on civil liberties and constitutional rights. Other people disagree with me. I would say that overall in this presidential election, the choice is very, very clear, and I know that, you know, Obama may not be as progressive as many Americans would like, but I think when you compare him on economic issues, on environmental issues, on foreign policy issues, on health care issues, the chasm between his views and McCain's are a mile wide. And I also think that, you know, Tom, in 1932, in very dark days in the United States, the middle of the Depression, Roosevelt came to power, and Roosevelt had not been the most progressive governor in the history of New York State, you know. And he came around and he looked around what was going on in this country, and he took some very, very bold acts. But I can tell you about Barack Obama. He is a very, very, very smart guy. And I think he has a sense of history. And I hope with strong support from a grassroots movement urging him to move forward in a progressive manner, urging him to stand up to the big money interests who have so much power, with a strong Democratic majority in the House and the Senate, that we can, in fact, move this country in a very different direction. So, that's just my view.
Yeah, I agree, and undo some of this damage. Hack in Birmingham, Alabama. You're on with Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. How's everybody there? I'm wondering, Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, without showing no respect, why there isn't more fortitude in the Democrat or yourself party to filibuster or stop their filibusters or make them filibuster. I mean, you can filibuster, can't you?
Well, as a matter of fact, Pat, it is now here in Washington, D.C., 12:40 in the afternoon. We're going to be here to, I don't know how late tonight, because some right-wing Republicans are, you know, trying to stop some legislation, and the leadership here is calling their bluff. I don't know if we'll be here Saturday or not. I don't think
so. Harry's finally standing up to the Republican
party. But yes, I happen to agree with the caller. I mean, I think we should be very vigorous. I think the Republicans, and people don't know this, have instituted, I can't remember the latest number, I think it's closing in on 80 filibusters on major legislation. I've got a major piece coming up next week or 2 weeks that I'm worried about it being filibustered and the need to get 60 votes, not 50 votes. So I don't disagree with that. I think there should be more backbone here, and I think we should say to our Republican friends, if you want to spend Saturday, Sunday, Monday here, that's fine with us. We're going to be going 24 hours a day. We are going to protect the needs of the middle class of this country. What I only would say is that Harry Reid has a 51-49 majority, very slim. On many issues, foreign policy issues, we lose Joe Lieberman. Senator Kennedy is now undergoing therapy, radiation therapy for cancer. So in some ways, we don't even have a majority here. But having said all of that, I think, and, you know, I try to push the Democrats to be as strong and tough as they possibly can so that the American people understand at least some of us understand what's going on in the real world, and we're fighting for them.
I think part of Hack's question was, why didn't you or somebody else filibuster this FISA bill yesterday or the day
before? Well, I guess there was the realization that on the part of Dodd and the Feingold that we wouldn't have had the votes. We would have been shut down pretty quick.
So, you know, yeah, it would have been
a filibuster doesn't go on forever here. You know, if you get 60 votes, you're kind of finished.
Right. Okay. So it would have been a 30-second effort.
No. Well, it could have been longer than 30 seconds, but.
But, yeah, not much. Okay. Let's see. Carol in Mesa, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Carol, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I couldn't tell from the change in the. Good morning, gentlemen. I got something later on the FISA, but I'll talk quick. I apologize for not knowing the precise title or number of this matter, but Congressman Rahul Grijalva of Arizona has learned that the BLM is poised to destroy tens of thousands of wild Mustangs that have been removed from BLM lands at the behest of cattlemen and some Republican members of both houses of Congress. Supposedly, BLM has run out of money to house them. It's just part of the pattern of 12 years of Republican-run Congress and 7.5 years of the world's worst president to defund anything that has to do with environment and animal protection on our federal lands. Could you please do whatever it takes to stop them permanently from killing these beautiful animals?
Well, Carol, what I will tell you is Raul Grijalva is one of the best members of the Congress and is a good friend of mine and does a great job. I will look at that. I'm not familiar with that issue. What I will tell you is what an issue that I am familiar with is the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, a couple of weeks ago issued a statement that they were putting a moratorium on new applications for solar thermal plants in the Southwest. And I thought that was a disaster. Some of us worked on that. They ended up reversing their position. Because
good.
I happen to think that solar thermal, these are large power plants which can produce as much electricity as a small nuclear power plant. And we can build dozens of them in the Southwest, have a real potential for helping us deal with the energy crisis. So I was disappointed that they put a moratorium. I was glad that they lifted that moratorium, and we've got to move aggressively in that area. But I will, Carol, take a look at the wild Mustang issue.
Okay. Thank you. Juan in Fort Myers, Florida, listening on 940 Winds. Hey, Juan.
Hi. I have a question for the senator, and I have as the Democratic Party as a whole, and more recently Obama has moved to the right. I'm taking a second look at Ralph Nader, and I wonder if the senator would speak as to whether he agree more than the and with the Ralph Nader ideas of what is good for the country or what Obama is doing.
Warren,
yeah.
I strongly disagree with Nader's candidacy. Nader has a very exemplary history, being a consumer advocate and done a lot of good things for this country. But the reality of politics in the year 2008 is you're going to have one of two people becoming president of the United States, and that is Obama or that is McCain. And in many states, I hate to say this, a vote for Nader is simply a vote for McCain. I think McCain would be an unmitigated disaster. I think in almost every respect, he would follow the footsteps of George W. Bush. I just don't know that the country can last four more years with that. So I am very strongly supporting Barack Obama. My job and everybody else's job is to generate grassroots efforts to move him in as progressive a direction as possible. But I think a vote for Nader is a very, very big mistake.
Okay. Morris in California. We just have 30 seconds to a break here, Morris. A quick one. Morris?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air. Got a quick question?
Morris, did you say?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's me. Maybe I don't hear so well. I'm 88 years old, and I've been holding on so long, I didn't think I'd live long enough to get my question in.
Okay.
But I've been through, like you can add up the presidential terms I've been through, the rise of fascism. I served during World War II. And I'm concerned, and I want Senator Sanders' impressions. And incidentally, I loved skiing in Vermont when I lived in the East. I want his impressions about what would happen with a Republican administration in the next administration.
Sure. Okay, let's hold on to that question.
To the Supreme Court.
with regard to the Supreme Court. So your question is, what will happen with regard to the Supreme Court if John McCain becomes president? We'll pick up Bernie's answer on the other end. Morris, thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. And Bernie, we had a question from Morris, I guess it was.
Right, and Morris asked a very good question. We hope, Morris, you're going to live for many, many more years. We need your strength there. Clearly, McCain would continue the appointment of extreme right-wing judges. What that would mean is if you are a woman, your right to control your own body would be in great jeopardy, and Roe versus Wade might well be overturned. If you are concerned about civil liberties, I would have great doubts about what a right-wing court would have to say about an imperial presidency and the protection of constitutional rights. If you're concerned, among other things, about public funding of elections so that billionaires and millionaires just can't buy elections, I would worry about what a right-wing Supreme Court would say about that, among many other things. So Morris is absolutely right. One of the key issues in this election is the nature of the people who the next president will appoint to the Supreme Court. I have no reason but to believe that McCain will just continue right-wing appointees.
Yeah, and given the age and health status of the so-called liberal members of the court, who I would say are all, at the very most, centrists,
That's right. That's a very, very important issue. Right?
The next president is probably going to choose at least two, maybe three, maybe even four members of the court. Mike in Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for all the hard work you do. My question is the status of the Employee Free Choice Act. I'm really frustrated when I see these ads in this multi-billion-dollar campaign with Grover and the boys and where that money's coming from. Like, we don't even know who's funding
it. Hey, Mike, let me tell you. Well, you can take a good guess. One of the issues that Tom and I were talking about, Mike, and your question is a very good point. What Mike is talking about, the Employee Free Choice Act, is right now for many workers around the country who want to join a union, it is basically very, very hard for them to exercise their constitutional right. Many workers are browbeaten. Organizers are fired from their jobs for scurrilous reasons. And this would give workers, in fact, the right to join a union in a way that they don't have it right now. I think it's very important. But Mike talks about the ads that are coming on TV, and it's the same old story. It is the energy companies, the oil and gas companies, coal companies, have spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in the last 10 years on lobbying, on campaign contributions, on advertising. ExxonMobil is full-page ads in the New York Times. The big corporate interests will come out with their anti-union, anti-worker efforts. The financial services people will be there to protect credit card interest rates at 29 or 30%, and so forth and so on. So, Mike, we know where the money is coming for these anti-worker ads. It's the same old story. And, by the way, that's another issue. Clearly, in terms of the next election, Obama certainly will be for the Employee Free Choice Act, allowing workers to join unions, and McCain will be on the other side of that.
Yeah, indeed. Doug in Atlanta, Dan in Atlanta, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, actually, Dan in Atlanta here.
Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, hey, Tom. Good to hear you, Senator. Question I had, during the week of shows that you had in Denmark, I got to hear some of it. I thought it was fascinating. One thing in particular, you were interviewing one congressman from there, a woman who talked about how when she went on maternity leave, had someone stand in for her to make votes. And I wonder, why isn't that something that we can do here? too often you see congressmen and senators who might be out, say, Senator Kennedy with his surgery and Tim Johnson, and even, say, Senators Obama and Clinton and McCain who are out campaigning. Why can't they have someone stand in for them to make those votes so that way important votes aren't missed? I would think that would be something that would be a bipartisan effort and makes total common sense.
Well, it's, you know, it's, that's an interesting question. And I think my guess is the answer is kind of rooted in the Constitution, what we used to have, which we don't anymore. Some discussion about bringing that back is pairing. In other words, a guy who would vote one way and somebody who would vote the other way would say, okay, when neither one of us are going to be here, we're pairing our votes. You know, it's an interesting question, but you're really asking, there are so many things, in the Congress which really are outmoded and outdated. We waste a lot of time on things that we should not, I'm forgetting even the politics, but just the structure of the institution. I think we need to take a hard look at that.
Yeah. Interesting. Daniel in Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. I've got a question about the, home energy assistance program.
Good.
Right after George came along, my job went away, and I got kicked down into poverty, and I went on this program, so that I could afford to keep my gas on and still make my house payment. And I was on that for a long time, and finally I went to truck driving school and pulled myself back out of poverty. But the problem now is that now I don't qualify.
You're too rich, huh, Daniel? The problem is you're too rich now?
What?
The problem is you're too rich now, huh?
Well, yeah, and what they don't tell you is you pay a percentage of your income, but you still owe the balance.
Okay, Daniel, here's what we're trying to do. Your point is a very, very good point, and I think you speak for many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. The reason that a lot of bad things happen is that the states just don't have enough money. We're trying to literally double the amount of money that goes into the low-income home energy assistance program, give states more flexibility to deal with eligibility requirements. You should be eligible for the program. The problem is that there are probably people worse off than you are in your state right now. So by giving the states more money, which is what we're trying to do next week or the week following, there will be more flexibility, and hopefully you can get back onto the program.
Yeah, and this, we're talking about the program that is referred to as LIHEAP, the
Low-Income Home assistance. Energy Assistance Program.
Yeah, it needs
that
a new
is
name,
a program right? Which keeps people warm in the winter, and in some of the hot weather states, make sure their electricity is not turned off so older people and sick people can keep it their air conditioners.
We need to call it the Prevent America from Freezing to Death Act.
There you go.
You know, we've kind of come up with better names than LIHEAP, you know. This is Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, sanders.senate.gov. Check out Bernie's website. Get on his newsletter. It's absolutely great, a great source of information. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
us.
Good
to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Coming up next, John Eisenberg. He's an attorney who's going to be suing Bush over warrantless surveillance.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle.
This is Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. The second hour of our program. Last week on MSNBC, maybe it was earlier this week, Jonathan Turley, the professor of constitutional law at George Washington University, made the following comment about this current FISA legislation and a much broader issue, frankly, what's going on with the Bush administration. Here's Jonathan Turley.
You know, there was a recent judgment just a few days ago in the El Harriman case where a federal judge said, obviously the president committed an illegal act. That illegal act is defined as a felony, a crime, under federal law. So what the Democrats are doing here with the White House is they're trying to conceal a crime that is hiding in plain view, that everyone can see it. And so the argument for it is quite simple. Nobody wants to have a confrontation over the fact that the president committed a felony, not once, but at least 30 times. That's a very inconvenient fact right now in Washington.
An inconvenient truth for the Democratic Party. So this led me to an article on Salon.com by John Eisenberg titled Suing George W. Bush, a Bizarre and Troubling Tale. The subtitle, U.S. officials went to extremes to stifle our legal challenge to Bush's warrantless surveillance, but a federal judge says the program is criminal anyway. And that caused me to say, hey, let's get this guy on the radio and talk to him. John Eisenberg is with us. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on your show, Tom.
I should just, for our listeners, a bit of a bio. You're an attorney with Eisenberg and Hancock, LLP, and you're part of the legal team that is suing George Bush et al. On behalf of the El Harriman Islamic Foundation over warrantless surveillance. You also were one of the attorneys by Michael Schiavo's side in the Terry Schiavo case. You've litigated in appellate courts on a variety of civil rights and business issues, including free speech, the right to die, reproductive choice, mediation, ethics, and corporate fraud. And you teach appellate procedure at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco. Your website is eandhlaw.com.
Wow, I can see you've been on my website.
What... You sued the Bush administration. A judge said Bush committed a crime. What's the practical meaning of this?
The practical meaning of this in our particular case is that we now have to show some sort of evidence that our clients, which are not just Al Haramain Islamic Foundation, but also two of its lawyers in Washington, D.C., that our clients were actually victims of the surveillance program in order to establish what lawyers call their standing to sue, that
right.
They were actually aggrieved by the program. We now have to show standing. That's what the judge has told us. He has said the program is illegal. The president effectively committed a felony by violating FISA, but you're not going to be able to recover damages or establish its unlawfulness as to you unless you can somehow make some sort of preliminary showing that you were the victims of the program.
Now, you did have some documentary evidence of this. I mean, was there not a leak or something that came out that did actually demonstrate that your client was a victim of this?
Yes, that's what has made this case so bizarre. In 2004, when Al Haramain was being investigated by the Treasury Department for alleged terrorist ties, the government accidentally gave Al Haramain's lawyers, oh my goodness, gave Al Haramain's lawyers a copy of a top secret document that we contend reveals their unlawful surveillance. We filed a copy of that document with the district court when we filed our lawsuit, and the government immediately asserted what's called the state secrets privilege, claiming because the document was top secret, we could not use it to prove our standing. We litigated that issue for more than 2 years, and what the judge said last week on July 3rd, Judge Von Walker in San Francisco, was that you can't use the document to establish the surveillance unless and until you can show me some sort of preliminary evidence based on non-classified information that you were unlawfully surveilled. So that's where things got so weird. We have the proof.
This is like Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, it is. The proof. The judge acknowledged the fact that we have the proof, but said the way the FISA law is written precludes us from using this proof unless we can first prove what the document proves.
Right. So now this raises two questions. One, what do you think the future of this is going to be? How, you know, what's your plan of attack? And two, does this legislation that was signed into law by George Bush yesterday, these amendments to the FISA law, do they change your ability to sue the Bush administration for this criminal behavior? And I guess three, if you actually demonstrate that there is criminal behavior, Is there going to be any consequence to anybody?
Well, let's start with two, the FISA bill that the president signed yesterday. It does not affect our lawsuit. There are some 40 pending lawsuits against the telecommunications carriers for participating in the warrantless surveillance program. The bill that Bush signed yesterday gives immunity, effectively, to those carriers. It does not give immunity to the government.
So those 40 lawsuits are out?
Well, the plaintiff's lawyers are going to continue to fight by challenging the grant of retroactive immunity, but at the very least, it's a huge setback for those cases. For the time being, they're out.
Yeah, so it'll probably end up before the Supreme Court.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But our case isn't affected. The bill does not affect cases directly against the government, so it has nothing to do with us, except to the extent that it puts our case at the forefront at this point. Your first question, what's next for us? What's next for us is we need to do what Judge Walker has ordered us to do, which is to restructure our opening pleading in the lawsuit, our complaint, to allege sufficient facts to raise an inference, at least, that our clients were surveilled based on unclassified evidence. And we've been working on that all during the past week. I'm working on it today. I'll be working on it over the weekend. We're putting together all the evidence we have, the non-classified evidence, to make this preliminary showing that Judge Walker has asked us to make before he will let us use the secret document to confirm the standing. Third question, what are the consequences?
If I may just pause you for a moment at that point. Judge Walker has asserted this kind of Alice in Wonderland thing that this secret program may well be criminal, but you can only prosecute its criminality outside of its own secrecy. But it's secret, so we can't discuss it. So we can't, you know. But is he doing that because that's the law, or is he doing that because he's is it discretionary on his part because he might have been appointed, say, by Bush's father or something like that?
No, I don't think that has anything to do with it. I've been very impressed by the way he's handled all these cases. It's been really, for me personally, a pleasure to litigate before Judge Walker. I think he's really smart. I think he wants to do the right thing. He is no friend, I don't believe, of the government in this case. He said in his opinion that the program is unlawful, but he erected a rather considerable roadblock for us to get to establish that we were victims of it. Why did he do that? I think he did it because that's the way he read the FISA provision that applies to us.
I see.
It says an aggrieved party may use top secret information to prove certain things. And Judge Walker read that as saying we must first show we're aggrieved before we get access to secret information, which we're trying to get access to confirm that we were aggrieved. It is Alice in Wonderland. I think Judge Walker recognized that. In his opinion, he called FISA not user-friendly. Mm. So, we might disagree with the way he read FISA. We might not. The way we're proceeding right now is to give him what he's asked for,
which
we think we can do.
Okay. And in the minute we have left, what is the possible outcome of this?
Possible outcome of this, ultimately, what I want is I want at least five judges of the United States Supreme Court to say the program was unlawful. The president does not have unfettered power to disregard federal statutory law in the name of statutory immunity, in the name of national security. I want the United States Supreme Court to reject the president's unitary executive theory. As far as my clients are in particular, technically they're entitled to money, but that's practically irrelevant to why we're doing this.
Right. So this would just basically knock down the basis of much of what Bush has done. It'll be too late to be used for an impeachment hearing or something like that, presumably.
Afraid so.
Yeah. Okay.
Bush ends in another few months.
Yep. In 192 days, 11 hours, 34 minutes, and 26 seconds. John Eisenberg, attorney with Eisenberg and Hancock, LLP, their website, eandhlaw.com. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate the information. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use Paul Edwards writing prose. Anything goes.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. And yesterday on the House of Representatives, on the floor of the House of Representatives, we heard...
Resolved that President George W. Bush be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. Article 1, deceiving Congress with fabricated threats of Iraq WMDs to fraudulently obtain support for an authorization of the use of military force against Iraq.
Dennis Kucinich, great American hero, and currently on the phone with us, Congressman Kucinich. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for the chance to be on your show.
You're always welcome here, Congressman. You did the 35, I think it was, articles previously. You did the Cheney impeachment proceeding previously. In both cases, basically, they got dropped into a black hole. There are rumors afloat and afoot that this time Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers are going to take this a little more seriously. I thought we'd, you know, go right to the horse's mouth or whatever lousy cliche you want to use and, you know, the source. You're the guy who's doing this and ask you, what's going on with this?
Well, I'm hopeful that the House leadership is beginning to understand the importance of paying attention to the concerns of the American people that this administration took us into a war based on lies, that we have troops who are continuing to pay the price for it, the Iraqi people are continuing to pay the price for these lies, and the American people are seeing the resources of this country squandered in this war that was based on lies. So people will say, you know, why are you doing this now? Well, think about this. In the last month, since the first article, since the 35 articles were put out, Congress has moved forward to provide funding for the Iraq war that will go well into the next president's term. FISA has been passed. There's saber rattling with Iran. And all of this, the kernel of this, are the lies that took us into the war. Mm. This is imperative. We're losing our country to lies that took us into war, that have set up a national security state, depriving us of our civil liberties, and getting ready for another war against Iran.
Yeah, we're all right there with you on this, Congressman. You introduced this yesterday on the floor of the House. Where is it going? What's going to happen to it?
I want a hearing on this.
Yeah.
And on Tuesday, I will rise when the bill is read by the clerk to refer it to committee to have a hearing. Because the American people deserve a hearing on these charges.
Do you have any indication in advance that you will get a hearing?
Only that yesterday, for the first time, the Speaker indicated a slight shift in her position, that they'd be willing to entertain some kind of a hearing. Whether it would be a formal hearing on articles of impeachment or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe this, that if I get the opportunity to go in front of the Judiciary Committee and make the case, I believe that it would enable the Congress and the media to come to an understanding of the gravity of this situation.
Mm-hmm. So Tuesday you're going to lay this out formally. What can our listeners...
No, here's the procedure.
Okay.
I presented it yesterday to the House as a privilege resolution.
Right.
It then is going to lay over for a couple days. It'll come back on Tuesday. The clerk will read it. And then I will stand to ask it to be sent to the Judiciary Committee so we can have hearings.
Right. So what can our listeners do between now and then to support your efforts?
They can do plenty. First of all, I would urge you to call your member of Congress and ask them to request that hearings be held by the Judiciary Committee.
Right. We have a website, by the way, callcongress.org. It's got a bunch of toll-free numbers that will get you right to the
switchboard. That's great. And then
just give me your zip code, and they'll tell you who your member of Congress is if you don't know who it is, and just bingo. Okay.
And the other thing I've done is I've set up my website at Kucinich.us.
Great.
So that people who want to put their name onto the impeachment petition can do so, and then I've pledged that I will deliver those petitions personally to the members of Congress. You know, I cut through all the red tape. They don't have to worry about having an email to a congressperson or a letter to a congressperson or phone call getting lost in an avalanche of calls. I've said that I will. I'm putting these together in petitions by district, and I will present it to their congressman. So people will know that congressmen will know that individuals from their district have expressed an interest in action being taken. So if people go to Kucinich.us, they can sign the petition. I really appreciate that you're not letting this go as well, because this continues to be an urgent matter that there's no accountability. The Constitution is being attacked daily by the Bush administration. Yesterday, Karl Rove was required by subpoena to appear before a judiciary subcommittee. He did not appear. People are just basically ignoring the Constitution and ignoring Congress's
I agree. I'm also concerned that with this FISA legislation, we gave away civil litigation rights, and the president will give away criminal by pardoning everybody, and he can't do that if he's being impeached. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Kucinich.us. Get over there, sign the petition. Thank you, Congressman.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Somebody takes your tagline and builds it into a song. I'm flattered. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday. Our number 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, and AirAmerica.com, and I think it's HartmanRadio.com. It takes you directly to my page on AirAmerica.com. You can just go to AirAmerica.com and click on Tom Hartman. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts. Steve.
Hi, yes, Tom. All right, first, you're a true patriot, and I want to thank you for all that you do to keep us informed as to everything going on.
Thank you, Steve.
And the reason I'm calling is this morning I heard on that Morning Joe program they were giving Vincent Bugliosi a very hard time about his book. Right. I was wondering what you knew about that book.
Vincent Bugliosi has been a guest on this show. He's a brilliant guy. I mean, he successfully prosecuted 106 out of 107, as I recall, capital murder cases when he was the head prosecutor down in L.A. And he prosecuted Charlie Manson. He wrote a book about that, Helter Skelter, which made him a New York Times bestselling author. And he's written a number of other books since then. One of them on the Kennedy assassination, in which he called me an idiot. So,
well, he was wrong on that.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, he and I have a respectful disagreement on some of the aspects of that. But his most recent book, the calling for the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder,
right,
is suggesting that individual prosecutors have jurisdiction. They have standing. If somebody I forget the legal term for, you know, jurisdiction, I guess would be the word, has died in Iraq as a consequence of the Iraq war, and presumably soldiers, but I would think probably contractors as well, and that the argument could be made that they were actually murdered by the behaviors of George W. Bush, and therefore these individual, independent, local prosecutors should be bringing cases against George Bush for murder. And in his book, he lays out the exact legal strategy as a prosecutor himself of how to do it. And I think that his book is spot on. He's been on, as I said, he's been a guest on this show. We promote it. I believe it's for sale over at BuzzFlash. Of course, you can find it anywhere, BuzzFlash.com. You can find it anywhere else as well. Vince Bugliosi has knocked one out of the park with this book, and I'm totally, totally supportive of it. And it makes perfect sense that on Joe Scarborough's show they would be giving him a hard time, but at least they gave him some airtime. That's a good thing. Rob in Long Island. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was having a stream of consciousness rant on a blog the other day, and I kind of, it kind of led me to what I thought was a very logical conclusion, but I wanted to run it past you because you're a little older than I am. You remember things from this era a little more clearly than I do. In 80, when Carter was opposing Reagan for the presidential nomination, I remember very clearly one of the major points of the presidential race being the Iranian hostage situation.
Yeah. That was the issue on which the election ultimately turned. Carter was way out ahead of Reagan. In fact, when Reagan was first nominated, the Republicans were afraid that he had no chance. I mean, there was total discouragement in the Republican Party because they thought he was another Barry Goldwater. You know, he's a right-wing nutcase. They called him Ronald Reagan, the cowboy. And he was way behind in the polls right up until the last few weeks.
I remember all that, and I remember that it was very shortly after the election, or just after the swearing in, that the hostages were released. But let me ask you a question, because everybody, it seems to be fairly common knowledge that Reagan himself or members of the Republican Party were talking with people in Iran regarding the hostage situation and trying to quote unquote defuse the situation. But is it possible that maybe there was a compromise that might have been put out there, that if they would hold, you know, if they would agree to release the hostages at a certain timetable, that that maybe, you know, the U.S. would give, you know, if Reagan was in office, the U.S. would continue to buy Iranian oil, perhaps at a certain, you know, a certain price or a certain markup?
Well, they didn't need us to buy their oil. What they needed, Iran had at the time, you know, after they overthrew the Shah, which was during the Carter administration, they had all these weapons. I mean, this huge military infrastructure that we had been funding. The Shah was our guy, and it was all American-made weapons, American-made planes, American-made tanks, American-made missiles. You know, all this stuff. And they needed spare parts, and they needed missiles for their missile launchers. And so, according to Barbara Honegger, who worked for the State Department, in the back cover of her book has a picture of her standing between Reagan and Bush Sr. as president and vice president, shaking hands with them. She worked for both of them in her book October Surprise, which is out of print, but you can find used copies generally fairly easily on the Internet. In her book, she asserts and has some considerable documentary evidence, and I believe Gary Null wrote a book, I think it was Gary Null, or maybe Gary, I mix up my Garys, maybe Gary North, but one of them. Anyhow, there's another book of the same title, October Surprise, which makes a similar assertion that Bill Casey, who was the head of the Reagan-Bush campaign and was made CIA director afterwards, that Bill Casey and possibly George Bush himself, but certainly Bill Casey and a couple of his buddies, went over to France and negotiated with the Iranians and basically said, if you will hold the hostages until after the election, which will cause Carter to lose, and it did, then we will sell you those spare parts you want, those missiles and spare parts. And, in fact, they released the hostages the very minute that Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible in January. I think it was January 5th, the day that he was sworn in. And a year or so later, we discovered that fairly soon thereafter, the Reagan administration started selling spare parts and missiles to the Iranians. Now, the official storyline is that they were doing that to get hostages freed that were being held in Lebanon at that time. But this was actually the sales of these weapons to Iran began before the Lebanese hostages were taken. So, there's a lot of questions about this, and Congress effectively shut down the investigation. When the Iran-Contra investigation was authorized by Congress, they wrote right into the enabling legislation that there could be no investigation of any activity by the Reagan administration or the Reagan campaign prior to 1981.
Tom, just real quick, the reason why where I came up with that theory was we've been talking about Carter and his alternative energy policies for quite a while. Yeah. And the thought occurred to me that since Reagan wasn't an alternative energy guy, and as you mentioned yourself, took the solar panels off of the roof of the White House that Carter had installed, maybe that was part of the situation, part of the deal.
I think that this was just pure political opportunism. I think it was an October surprise. It's at that point, energy. Thank you, Rob, for the call, by the way. At that point, energy wasn't that big a deal. And besides that, you don't need to invade a country to get their oil. You can just buy it from them. The reason that you invade a country that has oil is not to get the oil. It's to make sure that your oil companies can make a profit getting the oil. I mean, the cost of getting oil out of the ground in Iraq right now is around $6 a barrel. It's very cheap because it's high pressure oil. It's close to the surface. It's very easy to pump out. The cost of getting oil out of the ground right now in Saudi Arabia is around $20 a barrel, $25 a barrel, because they've got to suck so much harder on the straw because the wells are as the wells go down, it takes more energy to draw the stuff out. So it was really cheap oil. So if you've got a country that has very profitable oil, and you invade them. And it's not, as I said, it's not to get the oil. It's to get the profits for your oil companies, which is, guess who's now moving back into Iraq. So, yeah. But that was the October surprise. And it was based in part on Nixon's October surprise. When Nixon was vice president after Castro took over Cuba, Nixon was made head of the Cuba Working Group and was pretty much sort of the acting president for the last half a year or so of the Eisenhower presidency, because Eisenhower had a heart attack. And Nixon put together this invasion of Cuba that was supposed to take place at the Bay of Pigs in October of 1960, because Nixon was being beat up by Jack Kennedy over the issue of losing Cuba to the communists, to Castro. And it ultimately didn't happen, but Kennedy inherited all the pieces of it. You know, Nixon put together the whole piece of it, the whole CIA operation down at the so-called University of Miami or Florida down there, and 10,000 people, this whole active thing, and that ended up turning into... But that was supposed to be an October surprise to flip the election in 1960, and it didn't happen. So that's my take on that. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, we've just got half a minute here before we got to take a break. Is it a quick one?
I don't know. I heard Jonah Goldberg on your program this week when you were talking about mandatory service of our young adults
Yes. To
our country.
Yes.
And a couple of things were going on. One, I think he did, which is minor, was to send out an email blast prior to the segment to tell all of his supporters to promote his ideas after his segment was with you was done. That in itself is okay, but the much more mischievous strategy I think he aimed for was to take the wind out of liberals' moral sails. He was really pushing that contrived and contortive conservative moral principle of not forcing people into service, and I think the selfish people kind of cling on to that. But I think we need to continue emphasizing our liberal moral principles that back up proposed policies, and that's what I called to talk
okay.
about.
Well said. Thank you very much, Bonnie. I agree. I think that, you know, as a patriot, as a citizen, I think that along with the rights of citizenship comes some obligations. There comes some costs. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yesterday was at the top of commondreams.org. I'm not sure if it's still at the top. It's no doubt on there. It's called Obama and the Progressive Base. And it was about the discussion that we had yesterday on this program at some length. And Norman Solomon is an elected delegate for Obama. He was one of the early Obama endorsers and supporters. He was promoting Obama's candidacy back when I was saying that my preference was John Edwards. So here's a guy who's been out there for a long, long time speaking on behalf of Obama. And in his op-ed piece in yesterday's Common Dreams, he says, a reasonably even-handed biography of Barack Obama published just last year describes him as an exceptionally gifted politician who throughout his life has been able to make people of wildly divergent vantage points see in him exactly what they want to see. And David Mendel is the biographer. And then he says, you know, some of Obama's progressive base who had been seeing him as a very progressive guy, as like kind of, you know, almost a Dennis Kucinich progressive, are he says, a growing disquiet among significant portions of Obama's progressive base. He says, even the New York Times, in a July 4th editorial headlined, New and Not Improved, has expressed alarmed. They say, we are not shocked when a candidate moves to the center for the general election, but Mr. Obama's shift is striking because he was the candidate who proposed to change the face of politics, the man of passionate convictions who did not play old political games. Okay, so that, you know, this is in reference to the FISA thing. But on July 8th, Norman Solomon says, Obama made a valid point, even if it wasn't exactly the point he was trying to make, when he, quote, disputed this whole nation notion that I am shifting to the center, end quote, and said, quote, the people who say this apparently haven't been listening to me. So Norman Solomon says, the best, you know, stop being disillusioned. He says, the best way to avoid being disillusioned is not to have illusions in the first place. On Wednesday, Norman Solomon writes, when Obama cast a vote in the Senate to undermine the Fourth Amendment, he fulfilled his frequent prediction during the primary season, quote, that I will make mistakes, end quote. This was a very big one. As an attorney who's well acquainted with constitutional law, he participated in damaging one of the most precious provisions of the precious Bill of Rights. But Norman Solomon goes on to say, Barack Obama is an extremely smart guy, and I can't remember a major contender for president less inclined to insult the intelligence of the public. Let's return the favor by directly challenging him when appropriate. We do him and the Obama campaign, ourselves and the country as a whole, no favors by opting for silence instead. We can help the Obama for president effort when we hold him to his good positions and move to buck him up when he wavers. Norman Solomon, this is just so brilliantly written. He says, while speaking of the Iraq war, Obama made one of the most insightful statements of the primary campaign. He said, I don't want to just end the war. I want to end the mindset that got us into war. And then Norman Solomon says, he needs to be held to that wisdom. Obama should feel enormous counter-pressure from the grassroots against the forces in the media and the foreign policy establishment that are pushing him to go wobbly on ending the Iraq war. He says, as an elected Obama delegate to the Democratic National Convention, I've been hearing from people who are upset by the recent direction of the campaign. He says, some progressives now disaffected might consider the prospect of Obama falling short on election day to be his problem, not ours. But this isn't about Obama. It's about whether the levers of power in the executive branch and the Supreme Court along with it are going to be redelivered into the hands of the right wing for yet another 4 years. Under a McCain presidency, we'd be back at square one, where we found ourselves since January 1. Putting Obama in the White House would not by any means ensure progressive change. But under his presidency, the grassroots would have an opportunity to create it. Along the way, let's strive to eliminate disillusionment by dispensing with illusions. No one who is a presidential candidate can proceed to overcome corporate power or the warfare state. The pervasive and huge problems that have proved to be so destructive are deep, structural, and embedded in the political economy. The changes most worth believing in are the ones that social movements can make possible. In other words, we need to speak out. We need to speak up. We need to hold people to account, even candidates, even Barack Obama, in particular, in fact, because I got this fundraiser from him in the mail yesterday. It said, this campaign is about you, not me. It's about the we. It's about the us. And I absolutely agree with him. And I think he's one of the best candidates for president that I've seen since Jack Kennedy in a long, long time. One of the very best candidates for president. And that's why it's all the more important to speak honestly to and about him and praise him when he does well and pressure him when he does poorly, in our opinion. I mean, you know, he's going to take into consideration a lot of different perspectives. We're not always going to get what we want. But to the extent to which we cower or we just kind of go along or we say, oh, well, you know, we're not going to talk about that. We don't want to do anything that would maybe hurt the election of that's the extent to which we totally wimp out, and we actually harm democracy in this country. We harm the democratic process, and we ourselves begin behaving in a way that's inconsistent with the standards, the ideals of the Obama campaign, the campaign that he's holding up, the campaign that he's putting forward, which is that we get involved, that we speak out, that we be involved, that we be going door to door, that we be talking to our friends, that we be participating in the blogs, that we be expressing ourselves. I mean, the essence of this is that on Barack Obama's own website, there is a lengthy and very often critical discussion of his position on the FISA vote. There are also a lot of discussions about all the things that he's doing with which we agree, and they are many. So I think that, as you can tell, I've been getting a lot of email on this, and the vast majority of it has been, thank God somebody's willing to say, to speak truth to power and to say what needs to be said about this. But then there's the occasional, oh, please don't speak out, and I hear that from some politicians, some Democratic politicians as well. And I say, I don't think that that's the position that Barack Obama would take. In fact, that's not the position he's taken on his own website. Instead, he says, let's have an honest conversation about this stuff. Don't be a wimp. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Anything goes Friday. Any topic you want to bring up, we can kick it around. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Harvey in Berkeley, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and I love your show. I learn so much every time.
Thank you.
I just want, as you know, California's forests are on fire.
Yeah.
And Governor Schwarzenegger has told us that these wire fires aren't just seasonal anymore. And climate, no thanks to climate destabilization caused by the production of greenhouse gases due to the burning of petroleum, natural gas, and coal.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, here in California and in the Bay Area, we're in water shortages.
Yep.
And water rationing, and these thousands of wildfires require a lot of water, a lot of our precious water, freshwater resources in our time of drought here.
Mm-hmm.
And what's worse is that coal-fired oil, natural gas, and nuclear power plants use 136 billion gallons of our nation's freshwater resources on a daily basis. Only agriculture uses more, and
right, especially the nuke plants, which need enormous amounts of water to cool themselves to operate. Yeah,
that's right. In fact, if you go to Google and you put in the words nuclear and then you put in the words water shortages, in fact, I'm looking at a article here, and the headline is "Drought could shut down nuclear power plants. Southeast water shortages a factor in huge cooling requirements."
Oh, it already has. There are a number of nuclear power plants around the world that have had to power down. I don't know of any that have powered all the way to zero, but that have had to radically scale back the amount of electricity they can produce because the rivers that they're near are down to the point where they can't provide enough cooling water for the nuclear power plant to operate.
There's all kinds of trouble, and that's just one of the problems with nuclear power plants. But at the same time, the good news is that solar electric roof shingles and solar electric roof panels use no water in the production of clean, renewable electricity.
Yep.
And California, as well as many other states, are experiencing severe water shortages, and I say it's time to get solar.
Yeah. Well said, Harvey. Well said. Absolutely. In fact, I just recorded a spot for a company in Los Angeles that is just doing just that. It's, they're going solar. In fact, let's see here. ABC Solar, this is just a California company, but the guys at ABC Solar, Southern California Solar Experts, and 866-40-SOLAR. So for our listeners on KTalk in LA, abcsolar.com. And I think that that's, you know, the fact that a solar company is advertising on one of our affiliates is just a sign of the times, I think. You know, you're going to see more and more of that. I mean, we have a solar company advertising here in Portland, too, on KPOJ. So, Mim, is it Mim in Stony Brook, New York?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Mim. I just want to tell you, on Wednesday, John McCain, addressing campaign contributors, said that it was disgraceful and outrageous that the youngest generation of wage earners were being made to pay for the retirement of the oldest citizens.
That's how the system was set up.
Exactly. But the, but the point is that I haven't heard anybody on media mention this. And it struck me that what he's trying to do is to sort of divide the youngest generation of wage earners along the age line because yep. he knows that's where the biggest voters are for Obama.
Well, that's something that, you know, the libertarians and the hard right conservatives, the ones who don't believe that there should be any social welfare systems at all, and that even an insurance program that we all pay into like Social Security should not exist. That's what they've been doing, is they basically try to convince young people that they're not going to have Social Security when they get old, that it's a useless program, that it's no good, that the people on it are a bunch of doddering old leeches, basically, you know, stealing from their paychecks, and, you know, try to reframe the entire thing away from what it, every, you know, Americans for what, 60, 70, 80 years now have realized, you know, it's an insurance program that not only protects against poverty and old age, but fully a third of the money that Social Security pays out literally goes to widows, orphans, and disabled people. Now, you know, a friend of mine, Michael Hutchison, broke his neck in Santa Fe, and he's living on Social Security. He's paralyzed from the neck down. And without Social Security, he'd be in huge trouble. I mean, Social Security is an important, a very, very important program. And by the way, let me add that McCain is not entirely correct. Starting in 1982, when Reagan doubled the Social Security tax and created the Social Security Trust Fund, what they did was they said that the boomer generation, the generation of people basically, you know, born about 25, 30 years earlier than that, would not only pay for the retirement of their parents, but would also pay for the retirement of themselves. And so prior to 1980, every dollar that went out of Social Security was replaced by a dollar coming in. So the current workers were 100% funding the retirement of the retired workers. But starting in 82, they said, we're going to continue doing that, and we're going to build a multi-hundred billion dollar, maybe $1 trillion savings account, so that when the boomers start to retire, we won't have to raise, we won't have to dramatically raise taxes on working people. So the boomer generation is the only generation that is not only paying for its parents' retirement, but also paying for its own retirement by putting that money in a savings account. And then when the last boomers die in the 2030s, 2040s, about that time, the plan is to do away with that trust fund and scale back that Social Security tax. And in all probability, that's how it'll work. I mean, you look at the actuarial tables, that's how it'll work. And the only fly in the ointment is that in 83, 84, when Reagan's economic policies were destroying the country and he cut taxes and all of a sudden revenue went through the floor, Greens, you know, he's like, you know, what am I going to do? The government's going to go bankrupt. And Greenspan whispered in his ear and essentially said, you know, if you borrow from Social Security and loan it to the general fund, that's government-to-government borrowing, and it won't show up as a deficit. And it won't appear to increase the national debt. So it's sleight of hand, and you can do it, and you'll get political benefit from it. So Reagan began that, and every president since him has continued it.
Yeah, well, there was one cheerful thought I had, which is that he is so out of ideas that
McCain.
He just keeps recycling all this awful stuff, you know, that didn't work for Bush and isn't going to work for him.
Yeah, well, you know, let us hope so, Mim.
Oh,
thank
boy,
you.
I have my fingers crossed. I offer up prayers every day. I don't even care what religion it is. I'll give anybody a prayer.
There you go. Yeah, light a candle for Barack Obama. Mim, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Gerhardt in San Francisco. Hey, Gerhardt, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. Say, since this is Anything Goes Day, I figured it'd be a good opportunity to upbraid you for some drastic thing you said last Friday. Last Friday there was a caller on, and you agreed with her lock, stock, and barrel that black people cannot be racist.
I did?
and then giving this.
Wait a minute. Gerhard, I would never be so stupid as to say that anybody can't be racist. Come on.
Well, you agreed with her. You sucked right up to her and agreed with her. And the thing was that this was this Marxistic definition of racism, which includes power. Okay, maybe you remember this now. Racism has nothing.
Rather than revisiting last week's conversation, why don't you put forward your assertion?
Well,
right now.
If you let me talk, okay. I shall. Racism has nothing whatsoever to do with power. Okay, and anybody of any color can be racist. And it seems that the easiest.
Oh, I remember what we were basically semantically splitting hairs, and her suggestion was that if you notice another person's race, and if you don't even like that other person's race, that's actually not racism, that is prejudiced. But if you act on that prejudice and deny that person a job or a place to live, then that's being racist. And I agreed with that definition.
That's where she and you both fall off the bridge, because when you try to jimmy around the definition of the word racism so that you do not fit in it yourself, like she was trying to do, you can't do that with the English language.
Well, I'd say, Gerhard, that we're all racist because we're all part of a system that's still racially unjust.
Oh, stop it, please, all right? You know, the easiest way to find a black racist is to simply find those that say that black people cannot be racist.
Yeah, I'm not saying that black people
black
can't be racist.
Right,
I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that the application of prejudice is racism, and it's widespread in this country, and it's institutional in this country.
Well, why didn't you tell her that? You swallowed
it. Well, I thought that's what I was saying.
Sinker. You swallowed it hooked.
That, Gerhard, you know, calling people names like that is just the saddest way to try to make a point. I mean, it's just the saddest way to try to make a point. 16 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. Yeah, we can talk about anything you want. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Your radio support group for We the People.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday, 866-303-2270, our phone number. Janet in Oakland, California. Hey, Janet. You are on the air.
Sorry, I had to switch phones.
That's quite right.
Thank you for taking my call, and I really appreciate the good work you do. I'd like to get back to impeachment, though.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush-Cheney impeachment movement started years ago, and for the longest time I heard you poo-pooing impeachment whenever a caller would bring it up with you.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, I mean, you would say, oh, impeachment, it can't happen.
I would say it's practically not going to happen,
right,
but I'm entirely in favor of the impeachment movement. I signed some of the early petitions on this stuff. I mean, along with David Swanson, my position, Janet, has always been in favor of impeachment. What I've pointed out is that we've got a bunch of spineless Democrats in the leadership of the Democratic Party who are believing, you know, this stupid political advice from the likes of Bob Schrum and Mark Penn that, it's going to be politically dangerous and you'll be punished at the polls if you do that. And they're believing the Republicans who are saying, yeah, please go ahead and impeach us, which is really, please don't throw me in that briar patch.
Well, all right. I mean, it was my impression that several years ago you would not support
No, you're probably mixing me up with Bernie. Bernie was actually taking that position, but I wasn't.
So there's a new...
And it's one of the areas where he and I disagreed and continue to disagree.
There's a newly created National Impeachment Network.
Mm-hmm.
It's nationalimpeachment.org.
Great.
So maybe listeners can go there and get more information.
Super.
And I hope you continue to make impeachment one of the priorities on your program.
Thank you, Janet. I think it's even, and I appreciate the call, I think it's even more important now because, as I pointed out over the last couple of days, because we have taken away the right to civilly litigate against the perpetrators of the violations of our privacy in the Fourth Amendment, that we need to prevent Bush from taking away criminal prosecutions. And I'm of the opinion that he fully intends to do so by using the power of pardoning. And if you read the Constitution, it says the president shall have the power to pardon except in cases of impeachment. And so if he's under, and keep in mind, impeachment is not a removal from office. Although I'm entirely in favor of that, that requires conviction in the Senate. An impeachment is merely an indictment. It's like a charge being drawn against somebody. Bill Clinton was impeached. He was not removed from office. You are impeached in the House of Representatives, and there is a trial in the Senate, and Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, both of them were impeached in the House of Representatives, but their trials in the Senate were unsuccessful, and neither one was removed from office. By the way, while we're on the topic of impeachment, let me add that I am strongly of the opinion that we should begin right now pushing our elected representatives to impeach Mukasey, the Attorney General, because the man is not doing his job. He is refusing to do his job, in fact, with regard to enforcing the subpoenas of Congress. And so Congress should move to impeach him and have him replaced with an Attorney General who actually will fulfill his job responsibilities. John in Ithaca, New York, you wanted to disagree with me.
Hello, Tom. Hello. First of all, let me say, I listen to you constantly. I listen to Air America here on 1470 WNYY, Cayuga Radio Group, and I do what you ask. We bought our dryer and our washer machine from Fair Appliance because they advertise on this, and it's, you're right, you have to support them. You're right 99.99% of the time, Tom. However, I'm getting very irritated with you, for calling the wussies that, like myself, that are complaining that the criticism of Obama on the FISA vote or anything else that he's done in moving to the right, it's not going to make a great deal.
As far as I can tell, that's the only thing he's done. You know, and frankly, it's the only thing of his that I criticize. I disagree with some of his other positions.
Let be that as it may, then. I accept that. But you seem to be damning us sometimes with faint praise and some with damnation. That kind of criticism really won't have a great deal of difference either way, but whatever difference it has in getting in the national election will be a negative effect on Obama. And you heard Bernie Sanders say today on your show, just in passing, but he said it, that this country cannot survive four more years of a Republican.
I agree.
McCain,
I absolutely agree.
And
I am as I've said many times, I totally support Barack Obama and his candidacy.
I hear you say that.
And nobody is God, John.
We're not talking about God. We're talking about the realism of politics.
No, you're talking about the deification of an individual.
No, I'm not.
Saying he can do no harm, and if he does,
not.
It's not to be discussed.
What has Russ Feingold, as brilliant as he is, or Dennis Kucinich, or any of them been able to do because they don't have political power?
Yeah.
Not
John, I'm sorry,
power.
But you know, the clock has run out on us. I mean, literally, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman program brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, supporting your radio station, letting them know that you like the show, if you do, and that you're listening, encouraging your local businesses to advertise on your local show. And also brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more about it at teamster.org. Downright crazy stuff going on in the world. Downright crazy. Yeah, the terrorist watch list that the TSA maintains. The ACLU just let us know. It has now passed, officially, 1 million people. 1 million terrorists in America. Tell me this isn't crazy. I'm telling you. It's crazy. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Miami. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind? Mike?
Yes?
You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love listening to your show. I always learn something new. But my expertise is in nuclear power, and the caller earlier said something about the California nuclear power plants requiring a lot of fresh water.
Well, no, requiring a lot of cold water. There, you know, there's nuclear power plants along, there's a big point, I think it's called, up near Charlevoix, Michigan, on Lake Michigan. It's probably, you know, going to have no problem for a long, long time. On the other hand, there are a couple of them in Europe. I know that there's one in Germany on the Rhine, where the river level went down last summer and the water temperature went up to the point where they had to decrease the power level that was being generated by the nuke. Because they didn't have enough cold water or enough of a temperature differential to cool to run the cooling towers.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a problem with the ones run off the rivers, but the two that are in California, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, both get their cool water from the ocean.
Right.
So they're really, I mean, they do use up fresh water, but nowhere near, I mean, it's not really an impact. So I just wanted to make that point. Also, because of the ocean, the California current brings in the cooler water, California is actually the ideal place to put nuclear power plants because the colder water makes it more efficient.
Other than that small problem of earthquakes.
There is that small problem. I used to work at San Onofre, and according to their engineers, that San Onofre is designed for an 8.0 earthquake. Now, of course, we don't want to test that. But, I mean, I'm a big advocate of using the pieces of the pie to try to litigate or limit the global warming problem.
Yeah.
And nuclear energy, I believe, is probably part of it.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I will respectfully disagree with you, but I thank you for your call, and I think that we have clarified the issue anyway of how the water gets used and for whatever value that may have. Van in California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Van.
Hey, Tom. I have a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
How will Obama's FISA vote look if he loses? And my point is, what was inexcusable about Kerry's candidacy was, as a Dem, he had the stage for at most 3 months and said nothing. My comment is...
Wait a minute. I must be dense today or something. I don't understand what you mean.
Kerry was a candidate. He had the attention of the country for 3 months at least.
Right.
And he didn't use it. He didn't say anything.
About what?
About the problems that we were facing.
Oh, I think he said a lot about the problems we were facing. He talked about poverty. He talked about education. He talked about the loss of infrastructure. He talked about
the problem, Tom. As you said yesterday, the Republicans represent a 40-year criminal conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, you're right. John Kerry did not address
right.
that problem.
Ford,
you're right.
Yes, that's the problem, though.
Yeah.
The Ford pardon, the Reagan pardons, the Bush pardon, Bush 1, Bush 2 pardons, and the Bush 2 pardons to come.
Yeah.
And David Bender yesterday said a good thing. You see, he was talking about the rope-a-dope, that he thinks that the FISA vote, the expanding faith-based initiatives, he's rope-a-doping. He's going to get in there and clean up. And I just have this suggestion. As an alternative to rope-a-dope, which I think was Kerry's strategy, don't blow the whistle on what's really going on, that we have a 40-year... I mean, Cheney and Rumsfeld have been really in power for 40 years.
Yeah.
It's a criminal conspiracy.
Yeah, Cheney was part of the... Yeah, they were hanging around in the Nixon administration. Roe was...
My point.
Yeah.
My point.
No, I agree with you, Van. But let me just put a fine point on something with regard to Barack Obama. You mentioned the faith-based initiatives program.
Yeah.
He this is something that I'm pretty familiar with. In fact, I've written about it in two of my books, and I've read a lot of the writings of the founders on this, and they would be very opposed to faith-based initiatives. And the thing that Obama, this fine point that he put on that has the so-called faith-based community, end quote, which is really, you know, a bunch of businesses that operate on a nonprofit basis, you know, but, you know, some people drawing some very large salaries and building huge empires. I mean, Pat Robertson is a billionaire now as a result of, you know, the faith, right? But in any case, what Obama said is that if you're doing good social work and you happen to be a religious organization, then the government can support that social work, but you can't discriminate in your hiring. Now, what that means in effect is, for example, you know, I used to be the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely emotionally disturbed kids up in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village. My wife and I started it back in 1978. It's still there and still running. And there's another one, a similar one down in Maryland. The one in Maryland, in their charter, they identify it as a Christian program. We didn't in New Hampshire. We identified it as purely secular. But the fact of the matter is that regardless of how they identify it, if they want to take state funds, they can't be evangelists. They can't, and if somebody's Jewish and wants to be hired there, in fact, my first program director not only was Jewish, but went off and started our program similar to ours, Hal Cohen, started our program in Israel called Or Shalom, which is now the largest child caring program in the country of Israel.
Fair enough, Tom.
But the point is that what Obama is saying is that you can't basically be a religion and operate as a religion and take federal money. I mean, he's tearing apart the Bush corruption of faith-based programs.
I'll accept that. But my overall alternative to rope-a-dope, my final comment, is I think Obama may really have only one winning line of play, and I don't think it's rope-a-dope. I think it's to go straight at him, tell the country about a 40-year criminal conspiracy, say he's going to restore the fairness doctrine, he's going to shut down Fox News, and he's going to remove tax exemptions for pseudo-churches.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think there's
restoring the fairness doctrine and shutting down Fox News is not going to win him any points.
He's got to fight it out. This is America. We have a propaganda machine on television.
No, I understand, and it needs to be identified as such. But I don't think it should be shut down. I think it needs to be responded.
The way
to break it up is to enforce the Sherman Act.
The way
to break it up, Van, is to enforce the Sherman Act, to break up the big media corporations.
And he can say he's going to do that. He's going to restore the fairness doctrine. We're going to reinstate the Sherman Act. And,
you know, there are talk show hosts who will never touch this topic.
Congratulations to you. And
let me finish the sentence, Van. There are talk show hosts who will never touch this topic, and you will see them on TV.
Fair enough.
There are others who will talk about this, and you never see them on TV.
But the point is, Obama's on TV.
Do you really think that... No, I'm saying the same thing will happen to politicians. I remember Louise and I were sitting on the couch watching Howard Dean being interviewed by Chris Matthews back the week that he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek.
But he wasn't the candidate.
At the peak of his popularity. And everybody was saying, this is the guy, and the media was with him and everything. And Matthews says, what do you think should be done with the big media companies? And Howard Dean says they should be broken up. And Matthews says, wait a minute, you realize that we're on MSNBC, which is owned by General Electric. Are you saying that General Electric shouldn't own a media company? And Howard Dean said, that's right. I think a media company should be a standalone company. It should just be in the media business.
I know that.
And the next day, the morning shows, the next day, we're asking the question, is Howard Dean insane?
Obama,
I mean, that's how fast the media turned on him.
He wasn't the candidate, and that's what I was saying about Kerry. Kerry had the podium, and he didn't do what I'm telling you,
it would be, you know, Van, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this point,
okay,
and there's a whole bunch of, you know, other callers who want to get in here, but I'm just telling you, and thank you for the call, and I understand your sentiment, but I can tell you, living and breathing the world of the media here, the media takes care of its own, and it destroys those who go up against it, at least at the really high levels, at the big levels. And, if Obama did that, he'd be toast, in my opinion. Barbara in San Rafael, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Barbara. Or is
Hi,
it Donna?
Tom.
No, it's Barbara. Yeah. Hey, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to support, I think, the gist of the sentiment of the previous caller, and also what you were saying earlier today about having to hold Obama and all of our elected officials accountable. I'm really concerned with talk show hosts and, you know, whomever, of us, like Carl Rove not showing up again for the subpoena, and what are we going to do, and it being this kind of a ripple of a laissez-faire attitude that wait until the next election and things are going to change.
No,
I
we
don't
can't.
Think we can afford to do
This is a criminal enterprise. Carl Rove is a criminal. Don Siegelman is absolutely right. And that's why I was suggesting yesterday that the House Judiciary Committee should begin by subpoening Bill Canary and or his wife Laura, although she's a federal official, and you know start running this as an organized crime prosecution. It absolutely needs to be done.
Can we take that one step further, because I think it's an excellent suggestion, and I'd like to hear what you think is the next step that can help to make that happen.
Well, all of us need to call the members of the Judiciary Committee, and as well as your own member of Congress, of the House of Representatives, and say, in the case of Don Siegelman, and go to donsiegelman.com, by the way, I before E, donsiegelman.com, and toss him a few bucks. In the case of Don Siegelman...
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer, my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, to Lauren Kirshner, Marcus Hillman at Air America Radio, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room. Hey. And to Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website. Hi, Mike. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you. Hello to you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to our program and for supporting our advertisers. And thanks to Ellen Ratner and the Talk Radio News Service for giving us a daily update of what's going on in the world. Ellen, you're in Dubai on the way to the airport. Do I have that right?
I am. This is the last call I'll make before I jump on a plane for 15 hours.
Holy cow.
But there's a lot going on in the good old USA. First of all, one of the things that is really interesting is there seems to be a feeling over here that there is going to sort of be almost a worldwide recession, not necessarily terribly long, but that the American monetary situation is greatly affecting other countries in a major way.
Yeah, this is because so many things are denominated in dollars, starting with oil.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, there's always talk here. I must see this in the newspaper every other day about whether they should get off the dollar standard and move to the euros.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that may happen. But speaking of money, there have been two interesting things. I think the most important thing is that they are trying, the White House is trying to quell any kind of rumors that they're going to take over Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. Although I have to say the Secretary Paulson this morning was pretty cryptic about it. And they, of course, are saying, and the President's saying, that they hope that, you know, they can rely on the regular forces and that this is not going to be a giant government takeover of something that has worked so well for all of these years. But it honestly looks like it's going to be very tough, and that is what everybody's talking about in Washington this morning.
See, it never should have been privatized in the first place. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were there to be a backstop so that people could more easily get mortgages. I mean, this is put in place after World War II, and they should have stayed in their original purpose and function rather than trying to turn them into for-profit corporations with stockholders. It should be the government that's the stockholder. It would be a non-issue if that was the case.
Well, that's absolutely true, but it's there, and the question is sort of now what? Because
yeah,
it's a complete mess with the mortgage crisis.
I know. This is all this stuff that Reagan brought us. All this insane privatization. Pardon my rant. You've got the news. I'm sorry.
Go for it.
No, yeah. No I've said my piece.
All right. The other interesting thing is that there is a global a warming document, which I have not, it has not come all across the wires yet, and our people in Washington don't have it as of 15 minutes ago. But the White House is coming out with a global warming document, and they're saying, well, they have to do all of this on emissions, but they're not saying why there's global warming, and this really seems to be that continual reflective of the, of what's happening, in terms of the fight between employee assistance program and, sorry, not, and not employees, EPA, the EPA, and, which is employee assistance as well. I just was looking at my initials. EPA and also the White House. And they have been fighting about this, and it is not, and it is Bush appointees as well as that guy that left that was not a Bush appointee, that had been a career guy. So, essentially, this had been, this has been going on for a long period of time, and it is continuing, and I have not seen what the White House has issued, but it's not apparently going to be very pretty.
Yeah, well, you know, Bush walking away from the G8, waving goodbye to everybody, saying goodbye from the world's biggest polluter with a big smile on his face, you know, basically giving you know, the one-fingered salute to every other country in the world. I mean, I don't expect anything to come out of this White House. It's going to be anything other than.
Well, possible. I don't either. But also, speaking of things going on with the Bush administration, it looks like a lower court has actually now, a higher court has affirmed a lower court and is now saying that the Bush administration may still have to let go of some of those energy, the energy task force list. So this is a continuing fight. And I'm sure the Bush administration is trying to run out the clock till the end of the administration.
Is this Larry Klayman's lawsuit from JudicialWatch.org, the right-wing group?
This is Judicial Watch, and I guess Judicial Watch hung out with Sierra Club. It's two unlike groups
right.
that have been together on this, but yes.
That's great. That's great. I, you know, that because it was Judicial Watch that got the documents. I mean, they actually got the maps that Cheney was passing out at the first energy meeting back before 9/11 of the oil fields in Iraq, you know, where the oil companies were carving up, you know, who's and a list of prospective buyers for the oil fields in Iraq. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, let me just say something about the Iraqi oil fields. That reminds me of a little conversation that happened here in the good old UAE. And that is that there are a lot of Iraqis floating around here, not just the visit from the prime minister, et cetera. And I'm a betting woman. I'm going to say that the UAE is going to get their crack at some of those oil fields, even before U.S. companies.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought that the U.S. companies were already coming in on a no-bid basis. Is that deal off?
Some are, but I think that the Iraqis are going to pull sovereignty. I am not 100% sure that it's not anything we're written here, but I will tell you I'd be very surprised. There may be some of these no-bid contracts, but don't forget they could be thrown out in a moment once there's some sovereignty.
Yeah, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see that happen. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Fly safely, Ellen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman Program, Carrie Lucas from the Independent Women's Forum. We're going to be debating changes to the Family and Medical Leave Act. What's wrong with seven paid sick days a year? How about 6 months a year? And Gene Healy from the Cato Institute on the cult of the presidency. Should be interesting. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.